This sort of strange beta can actually cause unexpected troubles. When I arrived on Sunday at Toronto Airport, you know, you have to fill in these declaration cards before landing, and you have to specify the purpose of your trip. And I ticked the box personal. And then I went up to the customs officer, who asked me, "So what are you going to do in Canada?" And I said, "I'm going to visit Perimeter Institute." And she asked, "What is Perimeter Institute?" "It's an institute for physics." And then she asked, "Well, who paid for your trip?" I said, "The Perimeter Institute." And she said, "Are you doing this as a hobby?" And I said, "Yes, I do this as a hobby." And then she sent me straight to the immigration office for further questioning. And they eventually let me go. Well, I would like to thank Chris in particular, but also you all very much for the kind invitation. I have, for quite some time, admired the Perimeter Institute from the distance and always envied the people who can work here. And so I consider it a great privilege that I can talk to you today and also spend the entire week with you. And I've already had a number of really exciting discussions and hope to have more in the course of the week. On a more personal note, I mean, as some of you might know, I'm also thinking at this moment of my wife, because she has been very ill for quite some time. And this is also the reason why my visit has had to be postponed a few times, because I felt reluctant to leave her alone for a week. But now she also kept insisting and saying, "I know this is really important for you. I want you to go. I can manage for a week." And I'd also like to say thank you to her, even though she's not here, for the support so that I can come. She might do so in a few days, so that's also why I'm saying this. I think to start off, I owe you some explanation why I chose this particular topic, where I come from, and what my approach is going to be. As Chris indicated, my training was more in nuclear physics, which is a totally different field. Within nuclear physics, I studied transport phenomena, and in this way studied non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. And I did that for a while, then also applied those techniques to other fields, such as solid-state physics. I did some work on random matrix theory in the context of mesoscopic physics. And in all I did, probability played a major role. And I realized that many people, including myself, have a lot of difficulty on a conceptual level really embracing probabilistic thinking. I think very deeply ingrained in many people is still this yearning for determinism. And I don't know if that's the same here, but in Germany, for example, students find the course on statistical mechanics notoriously to be the most difficult course in the curriculum, because that's where they are confronted with a whole new approach, the statistical approach, the probabilistic thinking. And while in quantum mechanics, you can still sort of console yourself with the fact that, say, the Schrödinger equation is a first order differential equation. So the wave function, whatever it is, evolves in a way deterministically according to this equation. So this some type of sort of pseudo-determinism that helps some people over the barrier. But certainly, in statistical physics, you cannot avoid the probabilistic approach. And I was struck, for example, when I was still a graduate student, by the fact that at the time, it was about 100 years after Boltzmann, I still remember reading in Physics Today a heated exchange of letters to the editor about the interpretation of the second law. So what I found is that in those domains of physics, be it in the macroscopic domain, the second law, or say the maximum entropy approach to statistical mechanics, or in the microscopic domain in quantum theory, whenever probability, the concept of probability is involved, many people struggle. And there are heated discussions about the interpretation and the conceptual meaning up to the present day. And I personally, sort of over the years, got more and more interested in these conceptual issues surrounding probability. And what I'm showing you today, or what I would like to discuss today, is really one element of sort of a larger program that has to do with the role of probability in physics that I would like to understand better. And if you wish, my mission, my personal mission in the academic life is perhaps mainly a didactical one, because I would like to elucidate and explain or describe as clearly as possible the role of probability in various aspects of physics. So that's sort of the picture where I come from and why I chose today's topic as, of course, a crucial part of this larger program. I personally subscribe to the Bayesian approach, the Bayesian view on probability, that sort of I know that has sort of very enthusiastic followers here at Perimeter, that views probability essentially as an extension of logic. It views probability theory as an algorithm, a means to reason in the face of uncertainty. And probabilities in this approach are not defined as limits of relative frequencies, but they are regarded as degrees of belief of some agent. Probabilities encompass the state of knowledge of that particular agent. And they can be assigned legitimately not just to ensembles where you have frequencies, but also to individual systems. The assignment of probabilities, however, is not entirely subjective and arbitrary, but has to conform to certain basic consistency requirements that essentially come down to demanding that if you have different ways of using the same information, then eventually you must end up with the same probability distribution. And if you sort of translate that into mathematical requirements, and that is sort of a famous article by Cox in the 40s who executed that program, you can show that these consistency requirements lead to the sum rule and the Bayes rule, which are really the two pillars on which you can erect the edifice of Bayesian probability. There's a quote by Niels Bohr that I personally like a lot, and that reflects a little bit this approach or this attitude. He says, physics is to be regarded not so much as the study of something a priori given, but rather as the development of methods for ordering and surveying human experience. And this quote, I think, expresses quite nicely the idea that maybe some laws of physics tell us something not only about an external world that we are observing and describing, but they tell us something about the way we reason about the world. I would like to give you an example taken from statistical mechanics, where you can see this attitude illustrated. And it's an example given by Edwin James, which I find very lucid. He discusses the second law. And he argues that the second law really is an immediate consequence of the requirement that macroscopic processes be reproducible, in the sense that if you perform the experiment a second time, then the process must lead to the same final state. If the process is reproducible, then from the initial preparation, you know in which final macroscopic state the system will end up in. So you can, based on your initial preparation of the macrostate, you can predict the final macrostate. Now, a prediction can never contain more information than the data on which the prediction is based, which means entropy being a quantitative measure for information, or the lack thereof, that the entropy associated with the final macrostate cannot be smaller than the entropy associated with the initial macrostate. It's a very simple argument that essentially says that the second law is an essential prerequisite for being able to subject a macroscopic process to scientific inquiry at all. And therefore, it is in this, within, I think, within this, it falls under this general idea that a law of physics, like the second law, actually says something about our ability to reason, in this case, about a macroscopic process. But let me come to the proper subject of this talk, which is quantum probability versus classical probability. Quantum probability, I mean, first of all, when I talk about quantum probability, I'm implicitly assuming or asserting that quantum mechanics can be viewed as a specific manifestation of a probability theory. And this, I'm sure, is all very familiar to you. But just to show you that if you interpret, say, the subspace of the Hilbert space with a hypothesis or a proposition about the system, if you view the embedding of a smaller subspace into a larger subspace of Hilbert space as a logical implication, if you interpret orthogonality of subspaces as meaning or logical contradiction of the associated propositions. And the density matrix as being sort of the mathematical representation of probability distribution, or more generally, an agent's knowledge about the system. Then you see that sort of the mathematical structure of quantum theory lends itself to regarding it as a form of probability theory. Now, if this is so, if we say that was the original starting point, the Bayesian view on probability theory, that classical probability theory really is nothing but an extension of logic, then we say quantum mechanics is a peculiar variant of probability theory. And if you combine these two statements, then the question is, can you regard quantum mechanics as an alternative and equally consistent framework for plausible reasoning? A modern way of phrasing the same question in view of the vivid activities in quantum information theory is that you could say quantum theory has opened up new possibilities for information processing, very efficient information processing. Can you also go the other way around and say can I formulate requirements or constraints on information processing and deduce from these, go backwards, infer from these the structure of quantum theory? There was an early attempt already started in the 30s by Birkhoff and von Neumann, and then later very much expanded by a number of people, mainly based in Geneva, called quantum logic, where the idea was to say that logical propositions about a physical system, they form a lattice that has a number of properties, complete, orthocomplemented, weakly modular, and atomic, but not distributive, which would be a classical, correspond to classical logic. So it's a more general structure than with the classical Aristotelian logic. And there is also the Boolean AND operation defined, however, in a way that is different from the classical definition of a Boolean AND. So it's a generalization of the classical logic. And the key result that the Geneva School obtained was that within such a quantum logic, propositions can always be identified with subspaces of a Hilbert space over some skew field. And that already gets pretty close to the actual mathematical structure of quantum theory. The success of this approach, however, was not quite complete because it left open which skew field it is. So it still allowed also for real or quaternionic Hilbert spaces. And it also, interestingly, failed for dimension 2. So only the result only holds for dimensions at least 3. A more recent attempt by Lucien, which actually has also had quite a strong impact on my own thinking about the subject, was to formulate originally 5 axioms. I understand that Lucien has since succeeded in compressing the axioms further. But the original 5 were So first of all, sort of definition of what probabilities are in terms of relative frequencies, a simplicity requirement, a requirement that says that a constrained big system is the same as a small system if the dimensionality is the same. Then rules regarding the composition of systems into a composite system, and a very crucial continuity requirement that demands that if you have two pure states, then there's always a continuous reversible transformation to take one through the other. Now, I personally had, when I first saw this original paper, a number of open questions. I had an issue with the relative frequency definition because it's not quite in keeping with the Bayesian approach to probability theory. I had a question mark about the simplicity requirement, and I had a question mark about the continuity requirement because it singled out pure states, and I was wondering whether this could be maybe phrased in a more general way without giving a special status to pure states. I understand from Lucien that in the meantime, sort of this whole approach has been recast also in a form that is sort of in keeping with the Bayesian approach, more or less, you're indicating. But I think this issue has been addressed. I know that you are very intensely working on eliminating the need for the simplicity requirement. So I think this approach is, I personally find it very promising. It has certainly been a strong impetus for my own approach. And then sort of as a third, let me say, idea that I have taken up is that also the Bayesian view on quantum theory, a Bayesian view has been emerging in recent years, and Chris is sort of one of the strong proponents of this approach, where also in quantum theory you view the state, the quantum mechanical state, as embodying the knowledge or the belief of an agent about a physical system. And there are also a few mathematical results that suggest a strong relationship with a Bayesian probability. For example, there is a quantum Bayes rule that applies to probabilities regarding exchangeable sequences of quantum systems. So there's some mathematical evidence also that quantum theory can be recast in Bayesian terms. Now the questions for today are threefold. I mean, in what follows, I think I have three remaining chapters. First of all, I would like to just summarize briefly what the key differences are between quantum and classical probability. This is obviously something that I'm sure you know about. There's a vast literature, and I don't want to go into this very deeply. The main purpose of this is really to introduce sort of the language that I will use later on. Then there's another section where instead I will talk about the commonalities between quantum and classical probability, and there are actually quite a few. And these commonalities will also provide a hint at the minimal requirements that you would like to formulate for any kind of probability theory. And then finally, and that's really the, I think the key result that I would like to show, is the question, is it conceivable that next to classical and quantum probability, there might be yet further probabilistic theories that are still consistent in the sense that I would like to circumscribe, yet are different from classical and quantum probability? And the conjecture is no. In fact, classical and quantum probability are the only consistent realizations of a probability theory. And there is no other possibility. That's the goal of the argument. So coming to, first of all, to the differences between quantum and classical probability. I make here one simplifying assumption. I would like to restrict my discussion entirely to finite systems, where finite means, in the quantum case, that the Hilbert space dimension is finite, and in the classical case, means that the cardinality of the hypothesis space is finite. And I call that the size of a probabilistic model, as sort of the more general term. And in both cases, both classical and quantum, the logarithm of this model size, d, quantifies the maximum amount of information that can be stored in or retrieved from the system. I think, Lucien, you call that the information carrying capacity, which is very much in keeping with this language. So another way of phrasing it is that you can say that the resources available for information processing are finite in both cases. Now, there are many ways of, yes.
Are you thinking of sort of a priori that the notion of information has to make sense and can be quantified? That's built into human reasoning?
No, I'm not going to assume that for the general case. I'm just using it here to sort of to make the concept of the more fundamental notion is the model size, d, and not the logarithm of it, which corresponds to information. I only introduced that to make it maybe a bit more tangible for us. But it's not the fundamental notion. Now, regarding the differences between the two probability theories, there are, of course, many ways of describing them, and there's a vast literature on that. I personally would limit it to four key differences. The first difference is determinism versus an irreducible probabilism. So in classical probability theory, there exist distributions where all probabilities are either zero or one, and there's no residual uncertainty. In quantum theory, no such distributions exist. A second difference is that in the classical case, you have atomism in the sense that you can always dissect a large system into its parts, then describe the parts completely, and then the complete descriptions of all the parts give a complete description of the whole. In the quantum case, you have instead an inherent holism in the sense that the whole system may be in a pure state, but individual constituents are not. And that's, of course, the phenomenon of entanglement that you can have in the quantum case, but not in the classical.
So that's in the classical part, if you have correlated systems, how would you now distinguish that one from the entanglement part? Because, I mean, if you have correlated systems, of course, you can discover each system in itself does not reveal the correlation.
This is true. This is true. This is in that case, of course, you do not have complete information about the system. What I mean here, and maybe I should phrase that somewhat more carefully, is that describing the parts completely means that the parts are in the pure. So you have a large system, you decompose it into parts, and then you perform measurements on the parts. And you obtain maximum information about the parts. And this gives you then maximum complete information about the whole.
An alternative way of saying it is if the total system is in a pure state, then in the quantum case, that doesn't imply anything about the components, but in the classical case,
it implies that all the
implies all the components are also in pure state.
Yeah. Now, thirdly, classically, there's realism in the sense that the act of measurement on the system merely reveals, but does not influence in any way, the state of the system. And this, of course, as you know, is not the case in quantum probability, where you have an observer dependency, and the image of reality that emerges through measurement reflects not only something about the system, but also the whole history of intervention with the system. And finally, remember that I talk about the finite case. I make this restriction, and if we sort of restrict attention to the finite case, then in classical probability, everything is discrete in the sense that the hypothesis space is a discrete set. You have a finite number of propositions. And reversible transformations on this set are discrete permutations. So the symmetry group is also a finite group. In the quantum case, on the other hand, you have a high degree of smoothness in the sense that even if Hilbert space dimension is finite, the hypotheses that you can formulate, they form a continuous manifold. And reversible transformations that you can do on the system or on the states, they form the unitary group, which is a continuous Lie group. Go through this very quickly. This is just the smoothness part. Maybe I should elaborate on a little bit more. So that's what I said here about the classical case, that hypothesis space is discrete set. Reversible operations are the symmetric group or the permutation group. And if you perform a reversible operation, then your probability distribution will also change in a discontinuous fashion, generally. And in the quantum case, you have instead a continuous manifold, you have a Lie group, and also the change of probability distribution under a reversible operation is continuous. Now, the very last statement, this continuity, can be expressed in mathematical terms in this way. If you have a state, rho, and you look at the eigenvectors or the eigenspaces of this density matrix that corresponds to a non-zero eigenvalue, and let's assume that all non-zero eigenvalues are greater than some threshold. Then as you perform an infinitesimal reversible transformation, unitary transformation, then it will not happen that these probabilities suddenly jump down to zero, but they will go down in a continuous fashion. And this property can be expressed in this way, that if you say whatever sort of this minimum, the smallest non-vanishing eigenvalue is of the density matrix, there always exists a neighborhood of the identity in the Lie group, such that if you when you apply an infinitesimal group transformation to the state, then the resulting probability will still be greater than zero and not jump down to zero. So to summarize, there is, given finite resources, which was my first assumption, then as you go from the classical case to the quantum case, you give up realism, you give up atomism, you give up determinism, but what you gain is a higher degree of smoothness. Or alternatively, if you say in both cases I require smoothness, then as I go from classical to quantum, again I give up realism, atomism, determinism, but whereas in the classical case I need an infinite model size, in the quantum case I can do with finite resource, with finite model size, and still be smooth.
Sorry, what do you mean by giving up atomism? Probably corresponds to one of your boxes. I couldn't figure out which one.
If you remember here, the four key differences, then...
Oh, I see. This is separability of some problems.
Yeah. So you give up these three, but you gain smoothness as you go to the quantum. Mm-hmm. Okay, next, I want to talk about some commonalities. And I think this is much less discussed than the differences. But I think it's equally interesting because there's, I think, a surprising amount of commonality still between classical and quantum probability. In order to do that, first of all, it helps to introduce some sort of generic terminology that then includes both the classical and the quantum version, sort of as special cases. For example, what in the classical case is an element of the hypothesis space or an atomic proposition, and in the quantum case corresponds to a one-dimensional subspace or ray. In a generic setting, I would like to call a most accurate hypothesis about the system. More general hypotheses then correspond classically to a whole subset of the hypothesis space, or in the quantum case, to an arbitrary subspace of the Hilbert space. The observed hypothesis is zero, or the empty set. Logical implication corresponds classically to set inclusion, in the quantum case, to embedding of subspace into a larger subspace. Contradiction, classically, it's disjoint sets. Quantum mechanically, it's orthogonality of subspaces. A set of alternatives, classically, would be a collection of mutually disjoint subsets of hypothesis space. Quantum mechanically, it's a collection of mutually orthogonal subspaces. Sets of alternatives can be fine-grained, which classically means that these subsets are cut into even smaller subsets. Or quantum mechanically, you have an orthogonal decomposition into even smaller subspaces. What I would like to call the granularity of a hypothesis or a proposition classically would be the cardinality of a subset. In the quantum case, it's the dimension of the subspace. A special case of this is the model size that I introduced at the very beginning, which is the cardinality of the entire hypothesis space, classically, or the dimension of the entire Hilbert space, quantum mechanically. The state, classically, is a distribution on hypothesis space. Quantum mechanically is the density matrix. From that, of course, you can calculate probabilities. And then finally, there is the notion of a test, which classically is a map from a distribution to the distribution multiplied with the test function, where the test function is non-zero or is one only on a subset of the hypothesis space. Quantum mechanically, a test corresponds to rho being mapped to p projector onto a subspace, rho projector onto the subspace. Reversible operation, classically, it's a permutation. Quantum mechanically, a unitary transformation. What I want to stress is what I do not define in this framework are the Boolean operations and OR. Now, I would like to formulate four principal commonalities between classical and quantum probability.
Thanks for the question.
Yeah.
Given that you have a notion of logical implication, don't you get a notion of disjunction and conjunction in terms of suprema and infima and the quantum logic? Okay. So the least element that's implied by two propositions is the disjunction and in order induced by subspace inclusion disjunction.
From this you cannot deduce that this infimum is unique. So the traditional quantum logic approach makes that assumption, and therefore these Boolean operations are defined. But I do not make this assumption, and you can also not derive the uniqueness of such an element.
So didn't you say you were assuming that the automorphisms or whatever you call them were unitary maps? Or are we stepping back and saying that's special to quantum mechanics?
Well, I'm not yet in the final section of the talk, where I use only the general framework and then say except for classical and quantum probability, there's nothing else. But I'm still in the part where I compare classical and quantum probability.
So there you could define Andenor.
And there is still...
If you have Hilbert spaces.
Yeah, yeah, there I still could. But I refrain from doing it because also in the general framework, I won't use it. In my view, the main commonalities of classical and quantum probability are four. First of all, both have some sort of minimal consistency in their structure, which I will detail later on. Just to say that in both cases, the logical implication, logical contradiction, fine graining, granularity, state, test, and reversible operation are well defined, and they satisfy very basic consistency requirements. And I'll show you in a minute what these are, these consistency requirements. Secondly, I can define a number of sets, which I will also do in a minute. And that basically follow from the structure. And they can be grouped into equivalence classes. And these equivalence classes have only a single parameter. And this single parameter is the granularity, or the Hilbert space dimension. So the only parameter in both cases is the model size, the only free parameter. And if you have two models with the same size, then they have the same structure internally. Then what I call combinability, that's actually twofold. First of all, pertaining to states or hypotheses. If I have most accurate hypotheses, and I have two constituent systems, and I have a most accurate hypothesis about the first one, and a most accurate hypothesis about the second one, then I can combine these hypotheses, I can formulate a combined hypothesis, I can say, system A has this property, system B has the other property. And this combined statement is a valid statement about the composite system. I think it's very basic. I mean, it's translated into specific terms. In quantum theory, it just means if there's system A in a pure state, system B in a pure state, then the product of these pure states is a valid state of the composite system. Which is a very weak requirement.
It's a valid state, or it's a pure state of the composite.
It's a pure state.
That's a much stronger.
It's more strong. You're right. It's a stronger state. It's a valid pure state of the composite system. So that's a combination, the ability to combine systems or to combine hypotheses about systems. You can also combine operations on the systems. And here the commonality is that if I have reversible operations on system A, I have reversible operations on system B, I can, in an arbitrary fashion, combine these operations, and that gives me a valid reversible operation on the composite system. And finally, in both cases, both classically and quantum mechanically, it is possible, in the quantum case, it's not possible to learn the state of an individual system by performing measurements only on this individual system. But if you create copies of the system, if you embed the system into an exchangeable sequence of systems, and then you perform And you know that sort of prior information that the sequence is exchangeable. And then you perform measurements on different members of the sequence. Then from the results of these measurements, you can infer the state of a member of the sequence. And that is possible, of course, classically, but also quantum mechanically. Let me elaborate on these commonalities in slightly more detail here. First of all, the basic consistency requirements. The logical implication and also the fine graining, they are partial orders. They are reflexive, antisymmetric, and transitive. The granularity has these simple properties. It vanishes only if the hypothesis is absurd. If a proposition implies another proposition, then its granularity must be smaller than the granularity of the implied proposition. And if you have sort of two fine grainings related by, or two sets of alternatives related by fine graining, then the sum of granularities is identical. Yeah. And finally, for the probability, I do not assume, by the way, that probability distributions are normalized to one. They can be normalized. The sum of probabilities can be anything between 0 and 1. And again, there's actually quite similar to the requirements for the granularity. These are just very basic consistency requirements for the probability distribution. The concept of a test operationally can be understood as follows. A test means if I test for a property B, and let B be sort of a refinement of some coarser hypothesis A, then a test is defined as follows. If upon the measurement the proposition B is found true, then there's no further action on the system. If, on the other hand, the proposition B is found false in the measurement, then the apparatus is designed such that subsequently it also sets the proposition A to false. Let me give you a specific example here. Let's do a test on a photon. And the hypothesis A is the statement that the photon exists at all. And the statement B, which is a refinement of A, is that the photon has positive helicity, or a certain polarization. Now, a polarization filter is now designed such that it lets the photon pass only if the helicity is positive, i.e. only if the proposition B is found true. And you see here that exactly what I defined in abstract terms up here happens in practice. If B is found true, so if the photon indeed has positive helicity, then the filter lets the photon through and nothing else happens. Nothing else is done to the photon. If, on the other hand, the proposition B is found false, then the filter doesn't let the photon pass. And therefore, effectively, the photon is discarded. And then also the proposition A becomes false. Now the knowledge, now let's assume that the state rho describes the prior knowledge pertaining to all propositions that are refinements of A. Basically all properties of the photon, assuming that the photon exists. Now, this knowledge, in the course of the experiment, and it's a bit splitting hairs, but I think it's important to distinguish these two steps. The knowledge about the system changes in two steps. First step is that upon learning that the test was performed, but not yet knowing the result of the test, then the state changes from rho to theta rho. And then the second step is that I learn the outcome. Basically, I read the meter on the measurement device. And then there's another state change from theta rho to theta rho over this probability. Basically, it's renormalized to one. And you see, this is all to illustrate the physical meaning of this operation theta. It's basically in the course of such an experiment, it describes the change of knowledge in this first step, basically after performing the measurement, but before learning the result of the measurement. And this operation theta has, both classically and quantum mechanically, these properties. First of all, so the resultant, the posterior distribution, theta rho, gives the same probability as the prior for any proposition that's a refinement of theta. Secondly, the posterior here has a support that's contained in B with certain equality condition. And then finally, such tests, they might narrow the probability distribution, but they never broaden the distribution. So the granularity of the breadth of the posterior is never larger than the breadth of the prior. You could imagine sort of a stronger statement that sort of the support of the posterior is contained in the support of the prior. But this stronger statement is not true in the quantum case. The weaker statement is still true in the quantum case. And then finally, reversible operations, they constitute a group. They can act, you can view them as acting on states, then you have kind of a Schrodinger picture, or you can view them as acting on hypotheses, and you have kind of a Heisenberg picture. And these two pictures are related by this equation. In the Heisenberg picture, reversible operations preserve the logical relations of implication, contradiction, and fine graining, and they also preserve the granularity of a hypothesis. The support of the distribution transforms covariantly in this fashion, and so do tests. I realize that I have to speed up. I will do so. Here are the groups that I mentioned, the sets that I mentioned in the overview. We can consider the set of all refinements of a certain proposition A. You can consider the set of all sets of alternatives that are refinements of some proposition A with associated granularities Ki. You can consider the set of all states on L, and you can consider the set of all reversible operations that act on propositions and leave a certain proposition A invariant, and also all propositions that contradict A invariant. So essentially, this group G only acts on refinements of the proposition A. Now, in fact, these structures, these sets, they are, if you define them for a different proposition B rather than A, but if B has the same granularity as A, then these are isomorphic. LA is isomorphic to LB and so on. So you can really group them into equivalence classes that have as their sole parameter the granularity, or in the case of M, this granularity vector, or this set of granularities of the refinements. Let me look a bit closer at this set M, the set M of refinements of some proposition A. Just for you to visualize this more easily, in the quantum case, this corresponds to an orthogonal decomposition of Hilbert space. Now, the symmetry group acts transitively on this set, and therefore, this set actually constitutes a homogeneous space, and there's an isomorphism. You can express this set as a quotient of the symmetry group over the stabilizer group, which is the product of the symmetry groups G, Ki, where the Ki are the granularities of these alternatives. Classically, this gives a very sort of easy rule for the cardinality of the set. It's just the cardinality of the permutation group G of D divided by the product of the cardinalities of these groups G of Ki. Or in the quantum case, it gives a rule for the manifold dimension. In the quantum case, this is a continuous manifold, this set M, and it has a manifold dimension that can be expressed in terms of the group dimension. Now, this ability to combine systems freely in the this can be expressed mathematically in this way. You have here, these are the set of most accurate hypotheses about the system A, the set of most accurate hypotheses about the system B. And the Cartesian product of these two must be contained in the set of most accurate hypotheses about the composite system. And this just shows that this is indeed satisfied both classically and quantum mechanically. For the combinability of operations, there's a similar reasoning. There's the group pertaining to system A, group pertaining to system B, and the you can take any independent subset of these groups, combine them with a Cartesian product, and it must be isomorphic to some independent subset of the composite symmetry group, which quantum mechanically, for example, is reflected in the fact that the dimension of the composite symmetry group is in fact equal to the product of the dimensions of the constituent symmetry groups. What I require here, however, is a somewhat weaker, just that this has to be greater or equal than the product. Yeah, then the issue of learning, I mentioned that you can, in both the classical and the quantum case, you can learn about the state of a system by embedding it into an exchangeable sequence, then performing measurements on different members of the sequence. And for when you consider such sequences, then actually all the rules of Bayesian probability apply, the product rule, the Bayes rule, and the marginalization rule. They all apply. And in particular, this also implies the existence of a Diffinetti representation in both the classical case and the quantum case. And that's something that first showed a few years ago, that in the quantum case such a representation exists. Now, I have very little time left, I'm afraid, for the final part. The question here, the question is, as I phrased it at the beginning, we have classical quantum probability. They have commonalities. I list them here again. Now I say, I take this sort of as the core requirements that should be satisfied by any reasonable probability theory. And I ask, is there possibly a third one that also shares this core, but is different from classical or quantum, as we know? Now, you can first distinguish a number of cases. You can, if you look at hypothesis space, you can distinguish between a discrete case and a continuum case. And in the discrete case, you have, of course, the case where the symmetry group is finite, and then essentially you end up in the classical variant. In principle, you could have the scenario where the symmetry group is finite times a product of U1s, of phases. This still gives you a discrete hypothesis space, but you have a non-discrete symmetry group. I frankly am not quite sure yet what to make of this. I sort of label it as a semi-classical case, but there's a question mark because I'm not yet sure myself how this can be interpreted. But what I would like to focus on is the continuum case, where if the symmetry group is the unitary group, then of course you end up back in the quantum case. But the question is, could there be some other Lie group other than the unitary group? And since I restrict my attention to the continuum case, I return to the continuity requirement that I and the continuity property that I discussed previously. It's the same formula here. It's now it was already written in this more generic terminology and notation. So you can simply take this over and make this a requirement for your continuous probability theory. And this continuity requirement actually has far-reaching implications, and it restricts severely the set of Lie groups that are allowed. I'm afraid that my time doesn't permit now to go through the technical argument, but I'm happy after the seminar to show it to anybody who is interested in that. The upshot, and that's also that's sort of the core of the mathematical analysis. The upshot is that the dimension, the Lie group dimension, is restricted to be of quadratic form with two unknown coefficients, which is the manifold dimension of M11 and the dimension of the group G1, so of when you have model size 1. Now, this is not the only constraint. It's perhaps the most severe constraint, this quadratic form. But then, of course, since we talk about the continuum case, there's also the constraint that the manifold dimension for M11 that must be non-zero. And finally, I also use this requirement that reversible operations on constituents can be freely combined into a reversible operation on the composite system. And you remember that this gave a constraint on the also a constraint on the group dimension of this form. And if you combine all these, then this leaves you with four allowed Lie groups. Corresponding to two allowed values for the group dimension of G1 and two allowed values for the manifold dimension of M11. And you have here, of course, the quantum case as one of the four allowed cases. And the three others are the orthogonal, the special orthogonal group, and that would correspond to a real Hilbert space. You have the symplectic group, which would correspond to a quaternionic Hilbert space. And then you have the product of two orthogonal groups, SOD times SOD. Now, three of these four, namely SO, SP, and unitary group, correspond to the Hilbert space structure. And interestingly, this is actually in line with the old result of the quantum logic approach, even though here I did not use the Boolean operations and OR, but replaced that by some other requirements that then in the end result led to the same set of allowed Hilbert space structures. But then there's this fourth possibility, SOD times SOD, which frankly I'm not sure yet what to make of, and I'm happy to hear your opinion about that. This possibility gives rise to the same manifold dimensions for these sets M, and in particular for the sort of the manifold of pure states. So it might be locally equivalent to the unitary case, but I suspect that this group gives a different topology for this set and may be ruled out by some additional argument that constrains the topology of the set M. Well, this is still a question mark. Now what remains, here's the last requirement that I have not used yet, is that learning requirement. The possibility to learn the state of a system by embedding it into an exchangeable sequence and then performing experiments on other members of the sequence. And we saw earlier that this possibility to learn the system in this way presupposes the existence of a Diffinetti representation. But what myself as Chris has shown is that in the case of a real or a quaternionic Hilbert space, the Diffinetti representation does not always exist. And therefore, going backwards, you can say if in these two cases the Diffinetti representation does not always exist, then this implies that learning of the state by looking at an exchangeable sequence is not always possible. But since I require that, this excludes these two possibilities. So to summarize the talk, I think it can be summarized in a single picture. I looked at classical and quantum probability and first argued that the key difference between the two is that classically you have realism, algorithm, determinism, which you don't have in the quantum case, but then in the quantum case you have smoothness even when resources are finite, model size. Then I argued that there are four main commonalities. There is sort of some minimal structure with basic consistency requirements. There is universality in the sense that the model size or the granularity is the only parameter of the theory. There is combinability in the sense that hypotheses and reversible operations of constituents can be combined into the composite system. And finally, there's the learning requirement. And there's no other probability theory other than these two that shares this common core. And that is the argument that I wanted to describe to you. And that is the end of the talk. Thank you very much for your patience and your
since we're running over time, anyone who needs to go, go. But are there any questions?